wish you were as soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.
Morning sound stations carry no news of the world.
Corporate America owns all the networks.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is identification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch is Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen. The camera, the sword, by a Coke, by a Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
Elvis Presley.
O.J. Simpson, abandoned baby.
Order now.
What we want, what we need, what we want, what we need. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling proof. Who owns media? Who does this speak for? Your butt's on the sofa, your mind's at the door, and that's what entertainment's for. It's the drug of the century, the soul penitentiary.
Did you find you lost your virginity at the same time?
Time is right, and
waiting
pressure.
News scoop, what we need to know. News scoop, what we want to know. We got news scoop, what we think we know. Got remote control to choose the show. But the more we watch, the less we know. Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor. News scoop,
what we need to know.
News scoop,
what we want to know.
We got news scoop,
what we think we know.
Got remote control to choose the show. But the more we...
On the one hand, there's the public's right to know. On the other hand...
Hey, on that other hand, here I am, Danny Schechter, your news dissector here on PRN. Today, we just have a few announcements. We're going to be talking with some media personalities in a few minutes. We're trying to reach people who promise to be available, but hopefully they will be. I just wanted to pass this information on to you from the Washington Post. Nobel laureate Gabriel Garcia Marquez, the great writer, has died at age 87 in Mexico City. Here in New York City, Chelsea Clinton has announced she's pregnant. Death, life, all is on a continuum. We're hoping to bring our first guest on in a minute or two. We're trying to reach him now. In the interim, this has been a period of time with some shocking news about various people who've died. Michael C. Rupert, who I knew, is very controversial because of some of his conspiracy theories. On the other hand, extremely articulate about his concerns about what's happening to our planet and what will happen to our planet. Took his own life after his last radio show. So that was a shocker. John Judge, who worked in Congress, was a researcher, worked on Kennedy assassination issues, also just died. So there's been a spate of people dying, and in a way, we're struggling here for spring to be born. The difficulty, of course, once again, is to try to hope for a change of weather, and the change of weather often leads to a change in our overall temperaments. So that's... what I have to bring to you as we wait for our guest. I think we're trying again, and I'm not sure what happens when you book guests and those guests aren't here. But we do have on with us today Dr. Marwan Bishara, Al Jazeera's senior political analyst and the host of Empire. He was previously a professor of international relations at the American University of Paris. He's the author of Palestine-Israel, Peace or Apartheid, and The Invisible Arab, The Promise and Peril of the Arab Revolution. He writes and speaks extensively on global politics and is widely regarded as a leading authority on many of today's most relevant global issues. He's the senior political analyst for Al Jazeera. His program, Empire, is a very outspoken program. It was not on the air or not available in the United States at all. Now it's available online, but not on Al Jazeera America. I'm not sure why. We'll hope to ask him about it. It has been shown on Al Jazeera worldwide. And, Bishara's viewpoint is not simply to make an argument, but also to investigate issues. One of the recent programs that he did was called The Empire of Secrets. It was broadcast in June 2013. And maybe we can start and play a little of that for you. I'm Danny Schechter of MediaChannel.org. Here's Empire.
Surveillance of everyone. Who's in charge? And who's watching the watchers? Will anything change? And does this massive spending actually make America more secure? In the next hour, we decipher the top secrets. the open secrets, and the business secrets behind the intelligence industrial complex.
It's a global security state. It's not a national security state.
We venture into a world of dark secrets and dirty wars and reveal the ultimate secret of secrets. In a democracy forced to choose between rights and security.
I welcome this debate. I think it's a sign of maturity.
And so do we, because this is Empire. In 2013, Edward Snowden revealed that America's National Security Agency was listening in on, well, everybody. Everyone was shocked, deeply shocked.
This weekend, portions of a highly classified Pentagon document came to light for all the world to see, brought cries of outrage from Washington.
It was 1971. America was in the midst of the war in Vietnam. The Pentagon Papers revealed that presidents from four administrations, the generals and the intelligence services had all been lying about the Vietnam War. Everyone was deeply shocked. More stories about the CIA and the FBI spilled out of Watergate. Three separate investigations were launched. They discovered FBI agents in the post office steaming open letters without warrants, infiltrating civil rights and anti-war groups, disrupting them using blackmail.
The women's movement became the target of political surveillance. The United States Army had used more than 1,000 personnel to engage in domestic spying in the United States.
The CIA was also very active, operating inside the country, which was not permitted, going around the world, conspiring to assassinate foreign leaders, and even enlisting the mafia to kill Fidel Castro. The NSA was running Operation Shamrock, listening in on every electronic communication into and out of the United States without warrants, and had been doing so for 30 years.
Many Americans who were not even suspected of crime were not only spied upon, but they were harassed, they were discredited, and at times endangered.
You know, every day they'd get a whole computer disk, carry that down physically down to the NSA, and they would like listen to it and check out all the calls.
Everyone was shocked, deeply shocked. The NSA said they'd shut Shamrock down, but they hadn't, not really. In 1988, Duncan Campbell revealed that the NSA listening posts had risen into the sky. They were now satellite-based, and they had a new name, Echelon. Before anyone could get too shocked, 9/11 happened, and a pumped-up president stepped forward to tell America,
"I vow to do everything in my power to prevent another attack on our nation."
The Bush administration seized the opportunity to reject all restraints and let slip the dogs of snooping. The head of the pack himself promised that
everything that NSA does is lawful and very carefully done.
For carefully, read secretly. No courts, no warrants, nothing to slow down the action. Anything's lawful if no one knows about it. Echelon was giving a new lease of life and a new name, SolarWind.
The Bush administration decided unilaterally it could engage in whatever electronic surveillance it wanted to.
People were shocked, deeply shocked.
So help me God.
So help me God.
In 2007, Bush's Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez claimed the program had been discontinued.
So you're listening to an excerpt from Empire, the Al Jazeera documentary series, weekly series, hosted by Marwan Bishara, their senior political analyst, but not seen in the United States except online. And hopefully Marwan will join us and be able to tell us more about his program and about Al Jazeera America and what they're doing here and the work that he's done. As you could hear, his work is extremely well produced and very thoughtfully made. And I'm sorry, whatever the screw up is, I'll take responsibility for it. Marwan is not with us, but maybe he will join us. I'm trying to reach him. In the meantime, our next guest, the guest who was going to join us, is here with us now. So I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector with themediachannel.org, and I'm welcoming Elsa Rosbach, a filmmaker who I've known for many years, who lives in Berlin, Germany. Hi, Elsa. How are you?
Fine, thanks. How are you, Danny?
Thanks for stopping in and rather being with us a little earlier than I had thought. But, you know, Elsa's a filmmaker who worked in America, grew up here. In part, I think you grew up here all the way, right? Grew up in Denver, Colorado. You went to Smith College. And then with the assistance of the German government, you went to the Free University in Germany, German Film and TV Academy in Berlin. You've been an activist, but you've also been a filmmaker. And as a filmmaker and as a media person, you've had a chance not only to see what's happening in Germany and live there and work there, but also had some experiences in America, which were in a way very, shall we say, insightful about what was actually happening at public television. So tell us a little bit more about your background and what made you want to become a filmmaker.
Oh, what made me want? Actually, I was at Smith College. I was an art major, an art history major, so I had always liked to produce some kind of art, and then I also had a certain intellectual interest. I went to Germany initially to study philosophy and did study quite a lot of philosophy. But really it was, to some extent, the 1960s, the Vietnam War, and being so inspired by, or not inspired by, I should say, so moved and changed by the documentaries that I saw coming out of Vietnam is where I really began with my political activism in a serious way. I had done some sitting down in Woolworths in high school and so forth during the civil rights movement, but that I made me want to be a filmmaker and try to combine my various interests into that. And so then I, so that's been
but
what, a very
but when
main
you
interest.
Came when you came back to the United States in 1972. You became part of the team at WGBH in Boston. It's a station that I had worked for as well. It was considered, and some still consider it, the leading PBS station in the nation. And you were part of the team that launched Nova, which has been a long-running PBS series of science and science-related documentaries. But you developed a series of historical dramas on the history of American workers for PBS, working closely with the leading U.S. labor historians. Tell us a little bit about that, and how receptive was public television to your programs?
Well, actually, I would have to say I think the WGBH initially, at the time when I first got the idea to do this series, was quite receptive, or appeared to be quite receptive. This was back in 1973, because I... my interest in labor history began also in Germany, even as a student at the Film Academy. Many of us, of the students there, were making, we kind of rediscovered the labor movement as part of the, as part of what we were doing, and there were many fellow students who were going into factories and trying to make films about the contemporary German labor movement and so forth. So I came to the States with an interest already in labor history, and in fact with a plan to make a film about the Flint sit-down strike in Flint, Michigan. This was a 44-day occupation of a factory that actually was the most important success of the labor movement in the 1930s, and is considered the most important labor history event in the 20th century of the, in U.S. labor history. But in any case, so I already had this interest. But I was invited by public affairs director of WGBH to write a treatment for a whole series covering all of American labor history, and
just,
I did that. I'm
let me
taking
just,
a little
just,
too long, but I'm saying they invited me even to work there as a result of my treatment on labor history to begin with.
Let me just throw something in here, because we have something in common in this area as well. Not only did I grow up in a labor family, but I was a student at the Cornell University School of Industrial and Labor Relations, and I studied labor history. So we had that in common then, but you had access to actually doing something about it on television. And what is it that you set out to do?
Well, I was actually, as I said, I wrote this treatment at the request of WGBH, and then I was hired to work on NOVA, and I said right away, gee, I'd like to also try to realize this series, and they encouraged that. What the series eventually sought out to do was really to make Americans aware of this incredible heritage of struggle that we have in our country, which in fact had really changed many things, which had been a successful story to some extent, although a very brutal story and a story with a lot of tragedy in it, but fundamentally had achieved some real social change. And I have to say, I don't come from a labor family, actually. I came from a family that was more of a management-type family, and I grew up in Denver, which is not known to be much of a labor city. And so in discovering some of this history, I was just shocked that I had never heard of it before. And I think that my experience is probably in that regard more common. Well, I don't know, it depends on what city, but I think that many Americans had never heard of, let's say of a sit-down strike, like the Flint sit-down strike. They have not heard most of the major labor events. So I actually became for me almost a mission that, there should be some broad public education in this arena, and people need to know this history, and people need to know their heritage of struggle in order to successfully continue to struggle. And I believe that, and I came more and more to the conclusion that this is a story that's censored in the United States, really on a very, censored not as we think of it in the old Soviet Union, but the institutional forces prevent it from being told, whether in the schools, whether on television, whether in Hollywood.
Now, in your case, in case of this series, obviously, to produce a series of dramas costs quite a bit of money. Were PBS funders just standing in line to help you produce this series? How did that work? Because that's often where the politics of public television has the most effect. You know, can you get the money to make it? Could you?
Well, the one question is, where's the money coming from? Actually, at that time, because public television, many shows have a variety of different funders. There's the public funders, so the government finance, let's say, and then there's very often a strong corporate element, foundations, etc. In the case of this series, there was strong support initially from the National Endowment for Humanities, which encouraged this large idea, and WGBH encouraged this. I mean, I was working closely with the top management of WGBH and submitting proposals to the National Endowment for Humanities that had this rather, I would say quite ambitious project of doing a drama series. Incidentally, I don't know, it might have been a tactical error to even choose drama, but the historians I was working with, Herbert Gutman was one of them, David Brody, renowned historians, it seemed very important to deal with parts of the history that were before much film was shot. I mean, you could tell maybe the story of the 30s and the 40s and the 50s using a lot of documentary material and interviews, but to go before that, when a lot of the key things happened, drama is anyway what we chose. this was encouraged initially, and the research and development for the drama series was actually rather handsomely supported by the National Endowment for Humanities. And then what happened was they said, well, where are you getting the private sector funding? Because all of the public television and also the National Endowment for the Arts and the Humanities are set up with the idea that it's a public-private thing. But private is a euphemism, really, for corporate. And that's what I found out, because as we moved along to try to get the first funding for an actual production, NEH said, well, we don't think we can fund this unless we know where that there's going to be this private sector money. And WGBH actually sent me, I don't know if that was the most serious approach they might have taken, but they sent me to Mobil Oil and to others, and none were interested in financing this project together with the National Endowment for Humanities. And
at that time, we should tell people, you know, PBS was called in some circles the petroleum broadcasting company because so many oil companies were sponsoring certain programs on PBS, Mobil Oil particularly. But when it came to a labor series, that wasn't something on their agenda.
Right. But I should say one background of this is that the flaw altogether in the financing structure of public television altogether in the United States is the fact that there is no secure source of the taxpayers are not providing really a secure source of funding. The public they have to go and request the funding every couple of years from finance from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and it is a requirement that they bring this private sector funding into the picture, whether at the local station level or on projects like I'm trying to do. The local stations also have to raise a lot of money and they will raise it, of course, more from corporations and wealthy individuals than they will from working class individuals, because this was already at the very beginning. And then what happened, as you probably know, is that during the Vietnam War, Nixon vetoed public television broadcast that had been appropriated on the grounds that public television was too critical of the Vietnam War. So this sent public broadcasting, and it really was happening right when I started in that period when I was starting the project, into where they felt, well, we need to have another source. We can't rely even on the government funding that we normally would have or expect to have. We have to, and that's where the corporations were taking more and more influence in the 70s when I was developing this series. And I actually think that, I can't be sure of this, but I believe that WGBH, when I began the series, actually wanted to balance this. And they did encourage me even to go, because the next thing that happened was that Public Broadcasting Service said, well, you can have corporate money for a labor series, but you cannot accept union money instead of corporate money. You could, because union money would be biased, which of course is ridiculous. Both actually unions and corporations are in a sense biased with regard to labor issues, but they're equally biased. You can't say that only the unions would be biased potentially in a situation like that. So that became another roadblock, and that was overcome temporarily, it appeared, in 1980 through a very strong reporting in the New York Times criticizing the PBS approach, and a lot of support. The major historians, the Organization of American Historians, the American Historical Association, they also wrote to the New York Times, and this became a nationwide story. PBS bars unions from funding labor series, and it seemed that the very structure of the funding was playing a role, almost to censoring a critical part of American history that's really equally important as other major struggles like the civil rights struggle and so forth. You know, so
well, we had the same problem, Elsa, when we were producing the series South Africa Now.
Uh-huh.
And we worked through the Africa Fund. They say, well, the Africa Fund, they must have an interest in this issue. I said, sure they do. Well, that disqualifies them, you know, as a conduit for funding. I said, well, who is going to support the Apartheid Fund? I mean, who is going to support a series about freeing South Africa? And we had a big battle about that, and we were told we weren't being corporate friendly. So the issues that you encountered in the 70s were still alive and well in public television circles in the late 80s and early 90s when we were involved in trying to produce programming for public television on human rights. That's our company, Global Vision, that was producing all this. So we ran into this same kind of bizarre Alice in Wonderland world that was Orwellian in terms of how it interpreted, what was neutral and what wasn't, obviously.
Yes, but we actually, as I said, did have a breakthrough in 1980. We did have this breakthrough in which they relented, PBS relented and said, you can take labor financing for this project. And we actually received substantial labor contributions from some of the unions and smaller from some of the others, from over 30 unions. And I will say that I made a rule, because we were also seeking some corporate funding if we could get it. We would have preferred to show the project as, this is American history. Corporations and working people are deeply involved and implicated, and we would like to have all of them participate in the funding, and I made a rule that no corporation or union could see the scripts or have any input. And of course, anyway, all of the 30 unions that contributed would not agree about the labor history anyway. They have different viewpoints on what in the history. Some of them have different viewpoints of the first film we made in the stockyards. There were more left-wing union elements involved. There were others very more conservative. There's a race riot involved. There's different views on the relationship of the civil rights movement and black struggle to labor history. And so, of course, it would have been a nightmare to have any of them involved with the script and so forth. And none of them were. Corporations, though, I know that there was one moment where we then presented this to a retired CEO of a major corporation. We were assisted in trying to make an approach to big business, if you will, through John Dumlin, who was had been former Secretary of Labor and had many contacts and had been a negotiator, really, from Roosevelt, FDR, through Clinton, oftentimes. And This CEO took a look at the very fancy WGBH brochure with our 10 programs. The ninth program was the Flint sit-down strike. That was supposed to be a drama on that. And he said, what's going to be in this? And I said, we have major U.S. historians involved and the National Endowment for Humanities, and so we're asking both our corporate and our labor funders, they would not have any input on the scripts and so forth, but you can see from the brochure that we're going to do a very accurate historical thing. And he left the room, basically. And John Dunlap turned to me, and the fundraising expert from WGBH, and said, you are not going to be able to make a labor history series on public television in the USA unless you have the endorsement of the Business Roundtable, which is, as you probably know, it's a very active corporate lobbying group that had just defeated labor law reform that was sought by the AFL-CIO, had just defeated that a couple of years earlier, and really was doing a huge campaign during the Reagan era to dismantle to the degree possible the union movement, and to some degree succeeded. So yes, it was a hard lesson, but we did make this one film, and the film was a fairly large and ambitious drama with a large cast. It was the directorial debut of Bill Duke. It was made not only with NEH financing and ultimately American Playhouse representing the public television part and the 30 unions, and actually unions did get through their good relations with a couple of corporations, get smaller donations from Xerox Corporation and American Home Products, and then other foundations. There was about 50 different funders. I mean, Illinois Humanities, different sports foundations. I just want to say that working people themselves were so interested that this be made that the unions worked at half of their normal rate to make this happen. So that's all I want to say.
Well, yeah. I'm saying it's a tribute to your persistence and your commitment that something happened at all, and it also took you from being a wannabe creative producer into dealing with the politics and the finances of this series, and it took years and years and years of heartbreak, I'm sure, and problems, but you did get something done, and I admire you for that. I want you to stay with us, Elsa. We have to take a short break here, and we'll be back in a few minutes. And then we want to talk about your recent short film that you made in Gaza, and talking a little bit about your activism and your concern about Gaza. So stay with us. We'll be back in a minute.
To chase and to Wachovia, Wells Fargo, Sally Mae, to MasterCard and Citibank, and also B of A. American Express and Visa, Morgan Stanley too. In debt we trust, so pay we must, we owe it all to
Danny Schechter here on the Media Channel Radio. We're talking with Elsa Rosbach in Berlin, a filmmaker who worked in the United States, lives in Berlin, and has done a lot of activist work there on war and peace issues, and has recently visited Gaza. So bring us a little bit up to date, if you will, Elsa, on what has happened since you left GBH so many years ago and what you've been working on in terms of media projects.
Well, I would say first, actually, going back to the just one sentence about the killing floor, this unusually, although it was shown on TV before, it won an award in Sundance the next year and was invited to Cannes and all of that, and the New York Times said do the series and all that, so I initially spent a few years trying to see whether the whole series couldn't be produced, or at least another film in the series, and not one was, so I ultimately, since I had been to film school here in Germany, and I developed some screenplay ideas, I got the finances, and I said I'm going to come back. Initially, I was planning to be here just for a year or two. But once I got here, I found that I was able to develop certain projects, and I worked on one of them. Actually, I'm editing right now a much longer, complex documentary. But I also started taking a rather different approach to political filmmaking. You can imagine that the killing floor, as I described, and trying to get the labor series off the ground took years and years of essentially bureaucratic work, meeting all these different people, writing the letters, negotiating, trying to... And so now I've been doing a lot of filmmaking that's more what many young people are doing today, which is shoot it myself, edit it myself, go where I think something's important, and try to show what's happening. So I love also this. I like doing the drama, but I like also this kind of filmmaking very much. I feel it's very also that you sometimes can have very authentic encounters with people, and I feel that that's the case in this film about Gaza, you know, or about an experience that I had in Gaza, one part of Gaza.
You wrote to me about it and asked me, you know, how can I help you get this known and get this seen? It's on Vimeo. And, you know, I watched it, okay, and I was very impressed by it. And it really showed not only your passion, Elsa, for telling a story and showing the lives and the conditions that people are living in Gaza, but also the importance of covering something which is not getting a lot of coverage in the United States at all. You know, it seems like the Israel issue, particularly if labor has a hard time getting programming on the air or getting its issues shown, the issues of the Middle East, of Palestinians, of even the peace process, the conflict with Israel seems to have also had a terrible time in getting heard. And I know that you were recently in speaking with one of the people you worked with at Nova about this, about his experience getting a program on the air.
Yes, you know, my the brilliant, in my opinion, executive producer of who launched Nova, Michael Ambrosino, and who also was long time in public television well before I was, but he had the eye to do this, and he launched the series also Odyssey, and he also played a key role in assisting Henry Hampton do Eyes on the Prize and all this. I didn't realize how you know, Michael, to me, I was like a little filmmaker beginning there. Initially, he was like an executive up there. I didn't realize, you know, how progressive he was in some ways. But he decided to try. He was taken up by the, or got an interest in Palestine just through a friend of his, I understand, in Boston, who had, there was a study group of women of Israeli and or Arab and Jewish Israeli women in Boston. He came to some of their study meetings, and he decided he wanted to do a film about this, which he ultimately did for Frontline. And if you look this up online, you'll see that he went through incredible hassles, basically through being attacked for doing this film. This was in 1992. And I feel the way that he was attacked, the whole atmosphere around this film by this very producer who has this huge stature in public television, it had a strong chill effect. It was like a McCarthy era type attack, really, and so I'm sure that has played a. You know, that kind of thing, it plays a big role. Not everyone wants to stick their neck out. And anyway, once you make a film that is heavily attacked, you might not get another chance to make another film, period. So people are probably cautious.
But he also told you, according to what you wrote to me, mm-hmm. that films like his haven't been on the air since his was, for a long time. You couldn't believe it yourself.
I didn't. Yeah, I've been away, you know, from the States a lot, not watching a lot of public television since the mid-90s. So I asked you, I said, Tony, could this really be? He said he thought it was the last one. I was just Googling it now to try to prepare for this. You know, of course, public television does report on the Gaza-Israel struggle, but his was a very deep film that went into how the whole legal structures by which the land in the West Bank is being grabbed from the Palestinians, and by which the Israelis are creating these settlements that are really making any even two-state solution impossible because there's just no place for it, no land for a Palestinian state anymore, and he went deeply into this. He went into also torture and the legal system, how unfair it is against Palestinians. And of course, he went to Gaza when it was still occupied territory, also. And so, So he had done a deep and analytical film on, that was on Frontline, and I admire and respect that very much. But I think he knew, you know, he was almost retired at the time he made the film, that he could make a film like that and not worry about the consequences, perhaps regarding what's his next film going to be, you know. So.
Well, in my book, The More You Watch, The Less You Know, which was about my experiences at ABC News from 81 to 88, I tell the story of a segment that was produced about, conditions in Palestine. And not only was it very upsetting to the Israelis, who refused all cooperation with it, refused to be interviewed, have any of the leading people in Israel interviewed for this film. But before the film even aired, I was sitting in the ABC offices when several trucks pulled up, you know, like FedEx trucks with bags of letters attacking this piece 3 hours before it aired. Okay,
That's what happened with Michael's piece as well, actually.
Target of a campaign with letters by people who hadn't even seen it. So there's a tremendous effort by the Israeli lobby and other groups to try to prevent public debate and discussion of these issues, including in your film. And I thought maybe we might play a little bit of it. Obviously, you're a visual filmmaker, so a lot of the visuals won't be seen here. But I just want to give people a little feel of this. And this is Elsa Rosbach's visit to Palestine. And you'll tell us more about how you came to go there and what your impressions are now about the response to it. But here's a little of that.
You are about to witness a targeted drone assassination. It has already been seen by more than 4 million people after Israel Defense Forces posted it on YouTube. The date is November 14, 2012. The target, Ahmed Jabari, is riding with another passenger down a quiet residential street in Gaza City. Jabari is the acting military commander of Hamas, the Palestinian political party that was elected by a majority of voters in Gaza. He has already survived 4 assassination attempts. Israel calls this a pinpoint strike. It is said that the Hamas commander was on the verge of concluding a peace agreement with Israel on the morning he was killed. I had wanted to visit Gaza for a long time because of 3 facts. Fact number 1, Gaza is the part of Palestine under siege since 2007. Fact number 2, the U.S. and Israel do not include the 1.8 million people of Gaza in the Mideast peace talks. Fact number 3, U.S. taxpayers give the Israeli military more than $3 billion each year. Israel calls this a surgical strike.
Good morning, everybody, and you are all welcome to Gaza. This is a government compound. It has no military agenda, or it's not military in nature.
The drone execution was Israel's declaration of war. Israel Defense Forces attacked more than 1,500 targets all over Gaza, and there was heavy rocket fire from Gaza into Israel. 6 Israelis and 158 Palestinians were killed.
So we want to give a small donation on behalf of the Americans to the Shifa Hospital. Let the people of Gaza, the Palestinian people, and the world know that we are so ashamed. It's very small, $10,000, but it's a little symbol.
After 8 days, a ceasefire was declared, and I was finally able to visit Gaza.
Well, that's an excerpt from Elsa's film Visiting Palestine. How did you come to visit Palestine and make this film? And did you have access? What was your sense of your mission in doing it?
I should say the background of how I got interested myself in Gaza and Palestine, I came to it rather late compared to many others. I came to it because I'd been working with Code Pink on other peace activists, actions, Code Pink Women for Peace, the peace organization in the U.S. And so I was on Gaza Freedom March with them in the end of 2009 in Cairo, and we weren't able to get into Gaza. I was actually as surprised about that, or perhaps as I was about the funding situation in public broadcasting. I guess I'm a little bit naive sometimes, Danny, but I thought we were just going to go to Gaza and see, meet some activists there and have a solidarity demo. And we weren't even allowed by Mubarak to even meet in Gaza without, problems. And we wound up doing, these demos that were not even legal and, in these huge demos in Cairo rather than going to Gaza. So then after that I really wanted to go, and my son who was along that time was very interested, and he also worked in a hospital in Egypt then, and he was in Gaza for a while and so forth. So when I heard that, Code Pink was, and I was also then in the West Bank, and I took on some projects, primarily press work and also journalism work relating to Palestine. And so when I heard that Code Pink was going to go in and there was a change in the Egyptian government that might make it possible to actually go in, because before we were not allowed to go in because the Egypt wouldn't let us cross the border. You cannot get into Gaza from Israel, except for very, few NGOs that they approved to go in, and so so there was this chance to go. And also the reason that Code Pink was going is because there was another Israeli attack which began on November 14th, and you played that part of the film. It began with a targeted assassination of the Hamas military leader. And then there was this, these attacks. And so we wanted to go also to give a symbol, you know, stop the attacks. But actually there was a negotiated settlement, within 8 days. And so by the time we were able to get over there, it was already over. And I actually thought of not going, but I spoke with, a few people that I'd worked with, Palestinians I'd worked with in the past, and they said it's very important to go now and document what happened. So I think that was the attitude of our whole delegation. There were people from the National Lawyers Guild, there were people from ISM, International Solidarity Movement, and it was pretty much organized, though, by Code Pink, by Anne Wright and Nydia Benjamin and others in Code Pink.
Now, so, what did you see? Because we can't show the whole film, obviously. We only have a few minutes relatively left here, but, you know, tell us what you saw, what moved you the most, what angered you the most.
Well, this film is only one part of some of the material that I shot, to be honest, but I felt it hung together, and I'll tell you about what I saw here that's in this film, which was went to Jabalia refugee camp, which is about a half hour outside of Gaza City. And I had a wonderful guide, Mazen, who grew up in the camp. And the whole film was really shot within one day. It took quite a lot longer to edit it, at least to my satisfaction. But it was, and he took me around just, and I met different people. I met many of them spontaneously. I would say, can we talk to that guy? Can we talk to this woman? And, you heard the fact when I said Israel calls this a pinpoint strike. That material at the beginning that you played was from, the YouTube video that the Israel Defense Forces puts on their own, on their own website, and they called that a pinpoint strike. And then they had another bit of video they actually called it a surgical strike themselves. But actually I saw the total opposite. I saw that very normal, you know, people, just everyday people, their entire lives were, everything was targeted in a sense. The local police station was targeted. This one house was kind of shocking to see. I hope people will see the film. Because I myself, even though I knew something about the issue, and I knew that I myself was just shocked. I said, how can these people even deal with this? I mean, it was like Hurricane Katrina or something like that. If I could give an analysis of some Americans who might have experienced
this.
What was
interesting to me was some of the people you interviewed who just were saying, I don't know why. Why did they attack our police station? The police station is not threatening Israel. Why did they knock? Did they destroy the store in my grandmother's house here, the little store that she keeps? You know, what was the purpose? And I think part of the essence of the terrorizing of the population there is to do things that are totally irrational. We try to have an understanding that's based on some rational assessment, but by seeming to be crazy and to do take actions like these, you put the population, it really demoralized the population tremendously.
Well, you know, this is what I don't want to compare to. It's very dangerous to compare to the Holocaust, but I do know one thing: the question of why, when there's this kind of just unjust targeting of a whole population, there is. I'm not saying it's there is a collective punishment of the people of Gaza that's going on because they voted. They have continued to support Hamas. Actually, there's a little error someone pointed out to me in that section of film that you played, because actually it wasn't just the people of Gaza who voted for Hamas. Actually, Hamas won the election throughout Palestine. I believe it was in 2006, majority vote.
Yeah.
Because people thought, as I understand it, many people thought Fatah was corrupt. They wanted a change. They were looking for a change.
Right, and we portray it in the media here as they're, you know, kind of fundamentalist fanatics, and hence they voted for this terrorist group, Hamas. But actually, Hamas was providing a lot of social services to people in the community in Gaza, and as a result, won the support of the people there.
Not just in Gaza, though. They were actually won throughout Palestine, because remember they were not separate at that time when that first election came. Yeah.
Okay, we're running out of time, Elsa Rosbach. Thank you so much for being available and coming on the air with us to talk a little bit about your work and historically, your work historically as a filmmaker and your work currently. Which I have to say is very important and very impressive. As one filmmaker to another, I feel you bring not only passion but artistry to your work. So people can see this on Vimeo. What is it called? How can they look it up?
Actually, rather than just give you the number, if you Google my name, probably even just my first name, but Elsa Rosbach, Rassbach, Visiting Palestine, I think is the second thing that will come up on Google. And then if you're interested, you could see some of the different interviews and things I've done also with some leading Palestinian activists in the past. But you could just look up Visiting Palestine and my name, and it will come up. Okay. Unless you want me to give you the number.
I don't think anybody's going to write that down, but I think that will help us find it. Thank you so much for being with us. Clearly, this is an issue which our media doesn't do a very good job of covering, and many Americans are totally in the dark about what's happening in that country and the role the United States has played there, and that's one of the reasons why Media Channel is focusing, at least now, on this issue and bringing you an interview with Elsa Rosbach, who is someone who worked here in America and now lives in Germany but is continuing to do important media work. So thank you. If you want to comment on this program, you can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. The interview itself will be on mediachannel.org, and we welcome your comments and your thoughts and your reactions, because working for change and having some perspective on media coverage, what's covered, what isn't, is a vital part of that work. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector, and I'll be back again next week.